lovely guy, and I knew he was, you know, a reputable surgeon, but all of that was sort of lost in one particular detail, and that is that his hands shook very noticeably and quite dramatically. Now, I don't know how you would have felt about that, but I just know, like, when you're going to get surgery, there's not a whole lot of things on the checklist you're after, but a steady hand is sort of fairly high. And so I actually can vividly remember this scene, sort of there. And all I could see was, I don't remember what he said, because I'm just watching this guy's hands shaking. And there was a nurse in the office sort of sitting there, I guess, sort of assisting. And so the appointment ends, and I'm just sort of thinking, it's like, I don't know exactly how this goes. Like, can you opt out or, like, cancel this? And all these thoughts going through your head. And then she takes me aside. She says, I just want you to know that as soon as he starts to operate, his hands just go completely calm. She said, it's going to be fine. True enough, anyway, surgery, and she was right. Watched the whole thing. It's like, just completely calm. Surgery went fine. All is well. I tell you the story because I think there's something in that story that's going to help us understand Job's story. If you're just visiting here this morning, Job's story is worth becoming familiar with because sooner or later, probably you will live parts of it. You will face the questions of it, probably in your own life, of how does suffering work, of why is it there, who's God in the middle of all of it. Job wrestles with those questions for many chapters, weeks, months probably of his life as he goes through hard things, kind of trying to figure out who's God. If I'm going through this hard thing, how do I understand him? And Job knew a few things. He knew, in his estimation, it wasn't that he was a bad person. He wasn't suffering because he was bad. And he knew God was a great and powerful God, which left then only a few options, and most of them looked something like this. There must be something slightly wrong with God. He must not be just. And through the book, Job begins to wrestle with that question. And the three friends who come alongside him are quite insistent that Job has it wrong, that that's not the case, that God is perfectly just. And the world works almost like a machine in the sense that good people always prosper and bad people always suffer. And so in their very clean, neat, tidy understanding of things, Job must have sinned because everyone could see he had suffered. And so they just keep coming back to Job time and time again, saying, Job, what have you done? What's the sin? It's hidden. We can't see it. But Job, we know it must be there because you're suffering. And Job keeps replying, I'm innocent, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. That's basically 30 chapters of the book. By the time Job ends at the end of chapter 31 saying this whole thing, last week what we wrestled with was, is Elihu on track? In other words, is what he's going to say for 6 chapters worth listening to? Are these actual, real answers that you could take and bank on that are correct? Or are they more like the friends where we get to the end and we find out that God comes along and says, actually, the friends were wrong. In case anyone was starting to think they were right, just so you know, God says, chapter 42, verse 7, he calls out specifically those three men and says they're wrong. And my contention last week was that Elihu is actually a voice worth listening to. I gave you 9 reasons why, so I won't bore you with that again. But just so you know, from here on, I'm going on with the thought that Elihu actually sets the stage for God's answer. In fact, the way I read it, and please make sure you read this for yourself and don't just listen on Sunday morning. The way I read it is God's answer actually picks up from Elihu. Like Elihu starts the actual correct response and then sort of in essence hands the baton and God grabs it and carries on a very similar answer to what Elihu starts with. And so we need to understand what Elihu is saying into this situation because he's getting it more right than anyone has yet through this whole book. And Elihu's answer, and this is back to the surgery story, is essentially this. Job, what you might not have realized in all this is that in your heart, there was a problem. You weren't suffering because of sin. Like, that part you've got right. But in your suffering, sin was stirred up. And Job, all along, you keep saying that God hasn't spoken, but Job, what you've not realized is that the whole time God was speaking. He was at work. You've just missed it. And Job, my words, not Elihu's, my image, not his. God is like a surgeon who is using your suffering to deal with the issues in your heart. And Job, he can be trusted. He is an infinitely wise, skilled, great surgeon. And so Job, you're now at a turning point. You're at a fork in a road. Will you listen to him or not? That's really Elihu's contribution. We're going to walk through the speech a little bit, but just kind of so you kind of have a bit of an idea of where he goes, I think that's the gist of Elihu's speech, actually four of them, four speeches, so if you're kind of wanting just to figure out the structure, chapter 32 is his introduction, 33 is speech 1, 34 is speech 2, 35 is speech 3, and then 36 and 7 is the final speech that he delivers. Now, let's kind of buckle up, quickly go through the first three so that we have enough time for the fourth, because I ran out of time in the first service, really, for the fourth, which is really the key piece. So if you want to hear more on the first three speeches, find the audio from service number one, and we'll do our best to kind of make sure we can get to this last part. Speech number one, Elihu basically says to Job, Job, you have spent a lot of time defending your righteousness and very little time defending God. And Job, that wasn't right. Job, you probably should have spent more time reflecting on the character of God than on your innocence in all of this. And Job, the centerpiece complaint you've had against God is that he's silent. And we looked at this last week, but Job, the thing you missed is that the whole time he's been speaking. Well, maybe not the way you expect or want, but he was speaking. He spoke to you through your suffering. Now, that's chapter 33. So, again, we're just going to kind of move quickly and make sure we get the gist of these speeches as they unfold. A key verse, though, for you, and if you are into underlining or circling things, is coming up for us here in, I think it's chapter 33, and I want to say verse 17. There it is. Where we start to see what it is that Elihu has singled out that's broken inside of Job. And the issue is pride. And he uses a number of words through these speeches that really all mean the same thing. Pride, arrogance, conceit. And he says in chapter 17 that he may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. In other words, Job, what God is after often through suffering is to deal with pride that lurks inside all of us. And it might not be visible, it might not be evident, it might not have bubbled yet to the surface, but Job, through suffering, oh, it so often does. And it does, doesn't it? It has for me. Because isn't the first thing that happens inside our hearts when we go through hard things is we say something along these lines? It's not fair. And there is nothing to more quickly diagnose pride in our heart than that. It's not fair. Why? Why is it not fair? Because I don't deserve that. And Job's said the same thing all along. And Elihu comes along and says, Job, what God was saying to you through all this is that there's a pride problem. Now, please keep in mind, I'm saying something along these lines. It's not that Job started out as a sinner being punished. That's not the point of the book. The point of the book actually is the opposite. That Job is a righteous man, singled out by God because of his righteousness, to display the glory of God. It's actually much like in John chapter 9, for those of you really familiar with your New Testaments, where the disciples come along, they see a man born blind, and they say to Jesus, who sinned? You see, it's the same theology as the three friends. Who sinned? There's a man suffering, and so he must be punished. We're just not sure whose sin he's punished for. And their only question to Jesus is it his sin or his parents' sin? But he's blind, someone must have sinned. And Jesus' response to them is, neither. It's not the point. The point of this is that God is doing something so that he'd be glorified. It's almost identical to Job's story. It's not a story about Job's sin at the beginning and Job being punished. It's actually for the glory of God. But as the story emerges, through suffering, sin gets stirred up. Anyway, I won't go there. Time. Time, Don. Focus. And in 33, Elihu points out the specific issue. Job, the issue, it's pride. Okay, 34, really quick, goes something like this. Elihu now wants to defend the truth that God is just. And he will do it by saying, essentially, God is always just. God is perfectly just. And so, Job, if you think God isn't just, then you actually need to confront the true living God. Because, Job, God plays no favorites. He's just with you. He's just with kings. He's consistently, perfectly just. Now, he bases this in a really, it's a bit of a crazy theological point. And I'll just quickly point it out. If I lose you, I apologize. It's a bit of a weird way he tries to prove this. But if you've got your Bible open to chapter 33, verse 10, I'll point it out, and then if you want to talk more about it, you can come talk to me after the service. Here's what Elihu says. Hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. So Elihu is saying, like Job, God doesn't do wrong stuff. God doesn't do wicked. So Job, if your contention is that God's unjust, Job, you've just got it wrong. He doesn't. And then he carries on from that. For according to the work of man, he will repay. According to his ways, he will make it befall all. That's verse 11. In other words, God is perfectly, consistently just. It's just who he is. Verse 12. Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. Now, of a truth, that little thing, it's an idiom which just means it's unthinkable. God doesn't do that. The Almighty doesn't do wicked, unjust things. It's just not who he is. Okay, now, that's what he's claiming. Verse 13 to 15 is his theological basis for this. I just pointed out so that we grow in our understanding who God is. Here it is, verse 13. Who gave him charge over the earth, and who laid on him the whole world? There it is. There's the theological linchpin. You're going, that is? What does that even mean? Here's what it means in Elihu's argument. Elihu is basically saying, there is no one above God. God is not like an appointed delegate for an even greater God or being out there who's told to administer things on the earth. God is it. You see, Elihu knows something that you and I probably both know and have read about or seen or heard of, where you can have someone who might be a great, wonderful, benevolent power who then delegates authority out to a lesser person who then twists and perverts justice for their own good. You've seen that. You've heard of that. And Elihu goes, that's not God. God is not some lesser being down here twisting and contorting justice for his own ends. God is it. Okay, so if there's justice in the world, it has to come from the one who created the world. And if the one who created the world is it and it's God, Elihu's argument is basically, there is no other option. God must be just. Now, if that just went over your head, come talk to me afterwards if you're really interested. It's just a really important theological piece of his argument. If God, the maker, is just, he must be perfectly, consistently just. Otherwise, we wouldn't have justice down here in the rest of the world. Now, that's chapter 34 in a nutshell. God's just perfectly, Job. Chapter 35. Job is essentially asking questions. And Elihu, he supposes he can actually sort of muster up the questions Job's been asking. So here's what he says at the beginning of chapter 35. Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this to be just? Do you say, it is my right before God that that you ask, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned?" Now Elihu says, Job, these are the kind of questions you've been asking. What do those mean? Something like this. He says, Job, it's like you are imagining that your goodness has not gotten you anything. Therefore, if you had sinned, it wouldn't have cost you anything. That's kind of what the questions boil down to. Now Elihu's answer to this is maybe not what we would have answered. Elihu's answer is, Job, God is way bigger than that. Job, your problem is you don't understand how vast he is. And then he works to the particulars in verse 7 and 8. The greatness of God that he wants Job to consider is that God never becomes a debtor to anyone. Job, it's not about you doing a whole bunch of good stuff so then God's obligated to you to do good to you, Job. God's way, way bigger. He will never be obligated to you. Now that's chapter 35 in a nutshell, and I apologize for moving quick. It's just I want to make sure we get to 36 and 37. By the end of chapter 35, he actually says basically to Job, Job, you've been crying out to God, but it's like when people cry out for help, but they don't really believe in God. You see, not everyone that cries out for help actually believes in God. Sometimes they just cry out, and Job, I wonder, Job, if that's you. Oh, we hear you cry out, help, where are you? But Job, do you really believe him? All right, that sets the stage for 36 and 37, the key part of Elihu's answer. By the way, let me just point out one really fun verse before I walk through this. If you go to chapter 37, verse 6 and 7, I have been thoroughly rebuked by this week. Actually, I'm not kidding, in all honesty. I'm not going to ask you to hold me to account because I don't want to be held to account on this, but here's what it says. For to the earth, he says, fall on the earth. Sorry, to the snow, he says, fall on the earth. Likewise, to the downpour, his mighty downpour. So this is God. God says, snow, and it snows. God says, rain, and it rains. And then verse 7, he seals up the hand of every man that all men know he, sorry, all men whom he made may know it. Let me translate that for you into how we would say it today. God makes it rain and God makes it snow so that he stops us in our tracks. And you might have wanted to go camping or work in your yard, but God just said, rain. And the reason he did it is so that you would be stopped in your tracks, so that you would know you are a creation and he is the creator. I've actually been a little bit stopped on that one this week. It's like, you know what? There's a whole lot of days where I look out the window and go, why? There's my answer. In all honesty, there's a better answer than that, just so that I would know. I have the best plans, the best list. God just wants me to know he's God. Okay, let's dig into this speech here in chapters 36 and 37, because this is actually the key issue here from Elihu to Job. I'm going to sort of speed ahead a little bit as Elihu starts off by just saying, Job, just remember that God is just, he's mighty, he's powerful. And then by verse 8, he gets into the heart of the argument. He's talking about righteous people in verse 8. We looked at this briefly last week. We're going to carry on from that. If they are bound in chains and caught in the cords of affliction. Now, there's a righteous person caught in affliction. So you see why this applies so much to Job. Right, because Job was a righteous man now caught in affliction. This is exactly his situation. Here's what Elihu says. Then he, verse 9, declares to them their work and their transgression, that they are behaving arrogantly. In other words, Job, God does that to be able to communicate to righteous people caught in their affliction about their arrogance. Job, you see, that's what God's doing. Remember the pride from verse 17 back in chapter 33? Job, this is the surgery that needs to happen in your heart. Now he goes on from that. He says in verse 10, he opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity if they listen and serve him. You see, Job, you are at a fork in the road, my friend. God has brought this to bear in your life, and he's speaking if you listen. See, not everyone listens. In fact, as the chapter goes on, it imagines that very scenario. Verse 13, the godless in their heart cherish anger. They don't cry. You see, Job, there's some people who come to the fork in the road. Suffering's happened. And they say, I don't want to listen. I don't care what God might be doing. There's nothing that I've done that could deserve it. I'm not going to pay attention to that voice. Job's, some people do that, Job, but don't do that. Because you see what happens to them. It ends badly. They die in their youth. Nothing good comes of that. But Job, there's another group of people, the ones who listen. And then verse 15, he delivers the afflicted by their affliction. God works. It's like the surgeon who takes the scalpel. And the scalpel cuts. But Job, even as it's cutting, even if it's doing the work, it's actually delivering us from the sickness of our heart through the cutting. And Job, the affliction is the scalpel. Job, why would you ignore it? Why would you protest against it? Now, by the middle part of the chapter, verse 18, beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing. Isn't that just the human condition? It's like you get so mad. It's like, I don't care. You don't understand my suffering. And your anger can put you in a spot where you just stop listening and go, I don't care what God's saying. I'm so angry. I'm so hurt. I'm not going to pay attention. Job, beware of that. Carries on. Don't let the greatness of the ransom turn you aside. Isn't that brilliant? Think carefully on what's being said here. Job, don't let the price you're paying turn you from God. You see, suffering, it's a huge price. But don't let the price you're paying, Job, you're paying it anyway. That's what he says in the next verse. Will your cry, verse 19, will your cry for help avail to keep you from distress? No, the suffering's already happened, Job, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. You already lost your job, Job. You already got diagnosed with cancer, whatever the issue. It's already happened, Job. The only thing now you have to decide is what you do at the fork in the road. Your crying out doesn't change what's already taken place. So, Job, think very, very carefully of what you do next. Well, in your anger, you say, forget it. It's just too expensive. Or you say, maybe God will use this and in the affliction actually do something that's needed. Now, the rest of the New Testament bears this out. So I'm just going to give you the references. Hebrews 12, 10 and 11, 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7, 2 Corinthians 1, 8 to 9, James 1, 2. You can listen online and slow that down. Or come and ask me afterwards and I'll give you my notes. All four passages say essentially the same thing. Let me just slow down in one of them as an example. Hebrews 12, 10 to 11. Discipline is for our good. That's that passage. God disciplines those he loves. Not punishes. This isn't you've sinned and so God punishes you. That's all taken care of on the cross. Never forget that in this discussion. Like God does not punish us. If God was punishing us, you know, I don't know the implication of that, then Christ's death on the cross is not adequate. Right? But that's not what we believe. We believe it's 100% adequate. But God disciplines those he loves. That's what Hebrews 12 says, that we might share his holiness. And yes, it seems painful, but later, what? Fruit of righteousness comes. So God uses hard things for his purposes. And yes, it's painful, but the fruit of righteousness is the end result. It's the exact same thing Elihu's telling to Job. Job, don't let the pain stop you from hearing God. Now, because we're going to run out of time really quick, let me just ask you this next question. What is now necessary for Job next? You don't have to answer aloud. Just think for a second. I'm thinking if Job's being told God is like a surgeon who's going to operate on his heart, the pride and arrogance and the conceit that's inside of him, and he's going to use the affliction to do it, don't you want to know you've got a good surgeon? Oh, I do. Can he be trusted? Is he wise enough? Like, what if there's a misstep? What if in my suffering, it's all for naught? What if he doesn't know what he's doing? What if it's wasted? What if he's not powerful enough? Right? You got that thought in mind? Now consider everything Elihu says next and then everything that God's going to say following that. You want to know what all of it is about? The wisdom, the greatness, and the power of God. In other words, you have the best surgeon ever. Let me just read you some of the things that Elihu says to Job after this. Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know how God lays his command on them and causes the lightning of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balancing of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? You whose garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind, can you like him spread out the sky, Job? Do you know how to do any of that? Chapter 36, most of the vision is of a powerful storm, and God is at the center of it, directing the whole thing. He said, Job, when you come out in a night and look up to the sky and see a storm come across the Mediterranean into the desert, and you see the lightning flashing and the thunder cracking, he said, Job, it's all God. He is that powerful. He has that much understanding. You see, Job, you can trust yourself to this great surgeon who's going to operate on your heart. And he's going to deal with the pride. But just, Job, when you come to the fork in the road, don't get too angry. Don't resist. Don't say, I'm not going to listen to him. Now, Emmanuel, how do we apply it all? I think the one thing that we really need, Emmanuel, is a vision of the greatness of God. Like if we lose that, if we don't have that, how will we ever submit ourselves to a God who says, I'm going to lead you into affliction to do a great work in your heart? None of us will line up for that if we don't think he's great enough to do it with incredible wisdom and understanding. I've got good news for you the next couple weeks as we go into God's answer, because God speaks next. He's the next speaker in this book, and for four chapters, he's basically just going to say, I just want you to know how great I am. Yeah, in it, you're going to feel small. That's okay. You need to know how big I am. But never forget that God has purposes. And I want to point you to one last verse, actually one last little passage. I'll conclude with that one. I'll let you meditate on it this week, and then we're going to sing together. If you got your Bible, turn to chapter 37, verse 11. This is just one example of many in here. He loads the thick clouds with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around and around by his guidance. In other words, the clouds that you see swirling around, it's like God's directing. Those aren't just random. God's directing it. Every gust, every movement. And then listen to this. To accomplish all that he commands them. That is not random. God's accomplishing things. On the face of the habitable world, then verse 13, and this is the one I love, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. In other words, Emmanuel, there is an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise God who is accomplishing purposes that are more vast than we could ever imagine. Directing the clouds, sometimes for the sake of the land, sometimes to correct us, sometimes for love. We might not be able to understand exactly what's going on, but we can know that there's a God we can trust.